Hi, I'm Rob Wright.
And I'm Jen Follett.
And I'm Rick Whiting.
And we are here to discuss the top stories of the week for the week ending
September 23rd.
Oh, I keep forgetting the date for CRN for our front page five. And let's get right to it because we have a lot to talk about, obviously, with the biggest story of the week, which we'll get to at the end.
It's been a busy week, though.
It's been a very busy week. So let's start off. Jen, what was the first one?
The fifth one, actually, starting from number five, is a story about McAfee. Our colleague Kevin McLaughlin, who also had a very busy week himself, was doing a little story on McAfee and some word that came out about their plans for mobile and security and kind of ties in with Intel and that acquisition.
Yeah, a lot of people have been wondering kind of what is going to happen with McAfee now that it's part of Intel, and what's the overall strategy there? And they touch on that a little, I guess, but the interesting thing was just taking a look at how they're viewing what their priorities are going forward. And you know, the mobile device security is really interesting because obviously, you know, these mobile devices, they're permeating the enterprise, the corporate environment, whether they're sanctioned devices or not, you know, a tablet, a smartphone, whatever, and people are doing a lot of business on them, you know, not the same type of business you would do on your laptop, but still, you know, you're getting email, you're sending messages, et cetera, et cetera. So it was kind of interesting to have these guys come out and talk about, you know, where they see this going, you know, embedded security, application security on the mobile device, and how that's different than, you know, an x86 platform, a PC platform, which is, you know, where they built their business. I mean, they built their business in antivirus. So it was kind of an interesting glimpse into their strategy going forward. It still kind of remains to be seen what they're going to do with you know, the integration with Intel's, you know, hardware products, with their chips, with their, especially their embedded you know, processors for larger, you know, devices, larger systems. So, but they'll get there eventually.
I'm glad they're out there talking about it, though, because it's such a great market opportunity for the channel to really be able to come in and answer questions for some of these enterprise clients around mobile devices and mobile security, because it's a big mess for a lot of companies.
Yeah.
So for a solution provider to start to have some answers in that space is going to be really key.
Yeah, and one of the things I thought was neat was this this thing they talked about, the beta for their App Alert for Android, which was basically a dedicated solution for you know, mobile devices running Android, because it's been so
inundated
with you know, malware and viruses, and obviously it's an open source platform. It's a lot different than Apple's iOS. Couldn't be more different, actually. And you know, a lot of people like Android, but it's got some security issues. So it was interesting to see how they're kind of taking advantage of that opportunity and doing something about it. So, you know, kudos to them. It should be interesting to see what they do going forward.
Which brings us to number four story of the week, which is Oracle launching a new database appliance. And that brings us to you, Rick.
Sure. Well, earlier this week, Oracle unveiled the Oracle Database Appliance. And just as the name implies, it's a fairly simple product. What it does is they've taken the Sunfire server, part of their acquisition from Sun Microsystems last year, and preloading the Oracle database, Oracle's real application clusters, clustering data, clustering software, and a bunch of other goodies on it into a basically prepackaged, preassembled, one-button install system that's geared toward small and mid-sized businesses. Now, this is still just the hardware alone is, you know, $50,000 with the database. You're talking, you know, about six figures. So this is not a real, you know, something designed for one or two employee type businesses. But this is designed to be a channel product. They will sell some of it through the telemarketing, but according to Judson Althoff, Oracle's channel chief, about 90% of the sales of this are expected to go through the channel. So while from a technology product perspective, this is pretty straightforward, it's a big deal for a number of reasons. First of all, it's the first real appliance product that Oracle has. IBM has been doing this for a while, so they're sort of playing a little bit catch-up here. It's also important that even though Oracle has been selling Sun software and using Sun technology in its sort of high-end systems like the Exadata database machine, the Exalogic cloud server. This is really the first attempt to leverage Sun hardware combined with Oracle software specifically for a channel-ready product. So this is kind of like the first real benefits of the Sun acquisition that Oracle's channel partners can expect to see. And it also just shows Oracle's commitment to the channel. There have been some questions raised, particularly on the hardware side, since the acquisition among some Sun hardware resellers as to just how serious Oracle is about the channel. But this shows that they do consider their channel efforts to be serious and really want to go after it. So,
were the Oracle partners you talked to pretty excited about it?
Yeah, they are. I mean, most Oracle partners are, they're not selling low-end hardware products the way, let's say, a Dell or maybe like an HP reseller would. A lot of them tend to be more of on the systems integrator consulting side. Some of the ones I talk to are authorized resellers, but the reselling part is really just a small part of their business. But they do see this as an opportunity to actually get more into reselling, as well as an opportunity to sell to customers they may not have sold to before. Another interesting angle to all this is that, of course, Oracle is increasingly competing against HPE and IBM and Dell. Now they're competing on the hardware side. And several channel partners told me that there's a lot of customers out there who have Oracle software running on aging servers from other vendors. And they've been holding off refreshing that given the economy and so forth. So they see a potential right market there for going in with these kind of database appliances and upgrading and replacing those systems. And so this is a competitive challenge to HP and other hardware vendors out there.
Pretty cool competitive story for those guys.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, coincidentally, Oracle this week also announced their first quarter earnings. And as it has been last, really since the acquisition, their hardware sales had been slipping. It was down 5% to $1 billion in the just completed first quarter. Now, Oracle makes the argument that this is because they're basically powering down sales of low-end commodity servers and really focusing on the high-end Spark servers and things like Exadata and Exalogic, but still they really need to give a boost to their hardware sales. So they're looking to these kind of appliances to do that.
So that takes us now to the number three story of the week, which is Cisco coming out with word that they're going to do some teamwork and integration around Hyper-V.
Yeah, this is not, I guess, unexpected, but it's kind of interesting. Jen, you know more about Cisco than I do. Obviously, they are trying to be more of not just a networking company. They're trying to be more of a data center company. And just looking at what they're doing with the Hyper-V hypervisor and the upcoming version of Windows Server 8, it's interesting. It's because Cisco already has a relationship, correct, with VMware, right?
They sure do. Yeah, they have a pretty tight relationship.
So I'm not really sure. I mean, this is not like a shot across VMware's bow, but it seems like they're hedging their bet a little bit. They're trying to get a little bit more market share, mind share.
Yeah, I mean, they're clearly trying to establish themselves as a real deal player in the data center space, and they've played this game with a lot of vendors where they kind of, Microsoft is one of them, where they kind of tread the line between competitor and partner. And in this case, we're seeing, obviously a partnership with Microsoft, where, a lot of others, they compete. But the plan clearly is to show that it's not just about VMware. As I recall, Cisco actually had an investment in VMware. They have the VCE, the VCE alliance with EMC and VMware. So those three companies are like pretty tightly knit. But that's not the only game in town, and I think that's Cisco's recognition of that. And I think it'll be good for channel partners to be able to have another piece of the story to tell if they're trying to implement Cisco in a data center.
It's interesting too, because you don't think of Microsoft and Cisco going together the same way you do
peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah, or Microsoft, Intel, or other hardware, software. platforms, formerly, you know, HP and Oracle before that split. But this is kind of a little bit different, obviously. I mean, it's based around virtualization, and like you said, the VCE thing, you know, obviously they had an existing relationship with VMware, but Microsoft is trying really, really, really hard to get that sort of foothold or get more competitive in the virtualization space, and this obviously looks like it's a good thing for them to cozy up next to Cisco, which is already, you know, closely aligned in VCE with VMware. So.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely making some hay. Cisco is in the data center. I mean, they have a really compelling story to tell when you put all the integration together with the infrastructure, that the networking infrastructure that they bring to the table, the new Blade servers that they launched that are integrated in. That's the UCS product here. That's part of this announcement. And it's just, I mean, I think there's just a lot of interesting stuff going on in the data center space right now. HP's obviously a big player there, and they're kind of in turmoil, and there's just a lot of questions and opportunities, and the channel partners are kind of right in the middle of it, so it's a really good space to be playing in right now.
Do you think that this move by Cisco to go with Microsoft, or to also support Microsoft's virtualization play, is that kind of a signal that there's going to be more sort of heterogeneous data center, you know, multi-vendor stacks rather than sort of this integrated, or not integrated, or this sort of single vendor stack that we've all heard about, you know, with Cisco, HP, all these guys saying that they want, you know, Oracle, they want, you know, to own everything in the data center, from, you know, the storage, the servers, the software. Now it seems like with something like this, you're saying, you look at it and you say, maybe Cisco's trying to diversify itself. Maybe they realize that, you know, customers are demanding more than just VCE. They're demanding more than just everything be one vendor.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a bit of recognition that you really just can't afford to shut Microsoft out of anything.
True.
I mean, it doesn't make sense. So, I mean, that doesn't mean that they're going to give them equal footing to what they're doing with the VCE Alliance or with EMC or VMware as separate entities. But I think it's a recognition on Cisco's part, clearly, that they can't be only working with VMware.
Sure, yeah.
It just doesn't fly.
Right. Speaking of Microsoft,
the number two story on our list is a little bit of a controversial story, Rick, and it's about Microsoft, word coming out of Microsoft that there might not be as much compatibility with the new Windows 8 as we originally thought.
Right. Well, you know, for quite a while now, Microsoft executives have been talking about Windows 8, they've been promising that whatever runs on Windows 7, the current generation of the desktop operating system, will also work with Windows 8, which is pretty much expected sometime next year. And as you remember, last week at the Microsoft Build conference, it was pretty much the coming out party for Windows 8, certainly for developers. And those general comments were repeated by Steven Sinofsky, the head of the Windows and Windows Live division, and so forth. But a couple of days later, speaking before a financial analyst meeting, Sinofsky was asked about this and acknowledged that applications written for Windows 7 will have to be reported to Windows 8 if they're going to run on ARM-based hardware, not x86 or whatever. So it was kind of took everyone a little bit surprised, because it was kind of flying in the face of some of these broad promises of compatibility that Microsoft executives have been saying. And their response was, well, you know, obviously if it runs on x86, it doesn't mean it's going to run on ARM devices. They were saying Windows 7 PCs. They're kind of splitting hairs there a little bit. So it's you can kind of see their argument a little bit, but still it kind of took a little bit of the wind out of the sails of the Windows 8 announcement. And the key issue here is Microsoft is trying desperately to avoid the kind of debacle that they had with Windows Vista, where after it came out, there were also compatibility issues with applications and add-on devices and so forth. And they're bending over backwards for sure. That won't happen again, but maybe they've bent maybe a little too far over
it
backwards.
Seems like they overpromised. I think you were at Microsoft Build when I was in the office, and I remarked that I think that there's a little it's a little disingenuous for them to claim that Windows 7 applications are going to run on all, you know, everything's going to run on Windows 8, because it seemed to me like they were forgetting that there were going to be ARM devices that would run Windows 8. And obviously that'd be a different version of Windows 8 than the x86 version, but you just can't run like applications built for one platform on another without some tinkering or some porting. You can't just run them natively like and switch, you know, on and off between platforms. They're two very different platforms.
And if nothing else, I mean, if you don't do have them ported for like the ARM devices, then you're not going to be able to take full advantage of the capabilities like
right.
power saving and so forth. So
right.
it kind of makes sense you would have to port it. But and it just seems kind of a case here where I think maybe Microsoft let their marketing get out a little bit ahead of the technology.
What's the sense for how many applications or how many users are going to be put in this position now where they're going to have to make some choices?
Well, of course, they don't. Nothing runs on ARM today. The idea is that the ARM devices are going to be tablets. So that goes back to some of the questions we had about Windows 8 and so forth, is does Microsoft still have a shot at the tablet market? And the whole thing hinges on how much will Windows be adopted for tablets, or is that already a done deal with the iPad and a few other tablet devices already out there?
Yeah.
Obviously, their Windows 8 is going to do very well in the PC market, but you can add that question to the many about Microsoft's future as a player in the tablet market. You know, how many applications are going to be rewritten for tablet devices for mobile computing? How many people are going to buy a Microsoft-based tablet device?
It just makes it that much harder for a developer to work on a Windows-based tablet platform.
Right, right. They're going to have to, you know, develop applications from scratch for tablet devices, but it does mean they're going to have to sort of think about, okay, am I targeting my application toward the PC desktop market, the tablet market, both? They're going to have to spread their development resources a little bit thinner, and that applies to you know, channel partners, to ISVs, and the rest of the Microsoft ecosystem.
It's getting to be kind of like, and I'll just use this analogy because I'm a pretty big gamer. I play a lot of video games, but you know, when a game developer has to make a new title, they have to look at putting it on the PC, they have to look at putting it on the Xbox, the PlayStation, and you know, the Wii, Nintendo's platform, and they have to write a different application basically for all three or four. And that's kind of what's going to happen, I think, looking at this mobile ecosystem. With PCs, with notebooks and everything, you just had one platform. It was Wintel. Or even if it was, you know, Microsoft running on AMD, it was still an x86 platform. Now you have, you know, regular Windows 8. You're going to have Android. You're going to have iOS. You're going to have these app developers saying, where am I going to get the most bang for my buck? Where is the most money to be made? And do I really have the time and resources to write the same app three or four different times for all these different, you know, platforms with different requirements? And it's definitely going to put Microsoft in an interesting position, because they need to make it as easy as possible for people to make those apps. Otherwise, why even have Windows 8 for ARM devices? So
exactly.
And that brings us to number one of the week, and
yes,
that is the many, many changing faces of HP. We started earlier in the week with the reports that their CEO, Leo Epitecher, was on the way out, and that, in fact, became the case on Thursday night after the market closed, when the company announced that the board had replaced him with one of their own, a fellow board member, Meg Whitman of eBay, and formerly of eBay, and also maybe well-known to our listeners as a former gubernatorial candidate in California.
Yeah, this was really interesting. I mean, Jen, I think it's important to note, because I think it was last week that we did a podcast talking about
HP. Seems like we've been talking about
HP
every week.
Maybe it was the week before.
But, yeah.
And you mentioned, we were discussing, Ray Lane was at the recent Information Week conference, and the subject came up of, you know, why is the chairman of HP out there discussing and sort of defending the strategy?
Because it was supposed to be Leo.
You brought up that point that, you know, I wonder why Leo wasn't there. Does this sort of speak to there being a disconnect at the company? Is this a sign that maybe he's on the outs? And sure enough, you know, not you know, a month later, he is gone. and HP is reeling. I mean,
were I a betting woman, I may have done very
you
well.
You might
there.
Have put some money down in Vegas, and you would have done really well.
Yeah.
They're just reeling right now.
They are, and the news. I mean, I think it's pluses and minuses for the channel. I mean, I think a lot of the partners were instantly happy to see Leo go because they associate him with some very unpopular moves that the company's made during his 11-month reign, including the debacle that was the news that they were looking at spinning off the Personal Systems Group that's still in play. Are they going to do that or not? There was the disaster of the WebOS tablet, the touchpad lived about 6 weeks before they pulled the plug on that after much ballyhoo.
Yep.
And then there was the autonomy acquisition, which is still in the works also, which had a very hefty price tag, and a lot of shareholders felt maybe too high. So now they see Leo going, like, oh, thank goodness, he's gone. All these things are going to go away. But then we hear Meg Whitman addressing the analyst last night saying, hey, you know, I was part of the board that made those decisions. I'm not sure we're on the wrong track.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure what's going to change here.
I think the ideas and the strategies under the previous CEO were you know, the right moves. I mean, that to me is pretty shocking because I think, you know, I wish Andrew was in here because we had a discussion this morning, our colleague Andrew Hickey, our cloud editor. He said that, you know, autonomy was an interesting acquisition for HP because it seemed like a very valuable asset for HP to have, and a lot of guys in his area think very highly of autonomy. But the question is if HP is going to pay, you know, $10 billion, pay a serious premium for that company, what's the strategy? And that's sort of my issue with HP right now, is that what you're getting mixed signals. They're pumping up HP, you know, the HP touchpad. They're pumping up their mobile strategy. They have executives all over town the weeks leading up to our exchange event where they give away free touchpads to the attendees, saying the mobile strategy is key for this company. The WebOS is a key platform, and then they shut it down. And then they come back a few weeks later, Todd Radley says, well, maybe it's not dead yet. We're going to do another round of it since it's got such a great reception.
Yeah, we put it on fire sale and people actually bought it. Wow,
right.
let's revive it for another.
That's such a surprise. Yeah, $99. Of course people are going to buy it. But then you have like the PSG, like, well, we're not sure what we're going to do there. It could take 12 months. We could spin it off. We could sell it. We could keep it. Again, mixed signals. And then with autonomy, you go out and you buy this company for $10 billion. You've already spent billions and billions of dollars acquiring 3Com, Palm, other companies. And now you buy another company, a software vendor. You need to speak to a clear strategy. You need to explain where you're going with this and what it's for and how it's going to add value to the company and why you spent so much money for it. And there's no one to really explain it. There's no one there to say, everyone's saying it's the right strategy and it's the right move, but where does it fit within HP? And how is it going to affect the company going forward? And there's no one there to really speak to these things and give sort of a clear, divisive, this is my strategy and this is the way I am taking the company.
For me, I would have rather they came out and said, okay, clearly we made some missteps. Maybe Leo wasn't the right guy for us. We're going to name Meg Whitman as an interim CEO and we're going to do another search.
She's not the interim CEO.
She's not the interim CEO. They've named her the full-fledged CEO. They actually also made Ray Lane an executive chairman, moving him from non-executive chairman.
It just
doesn't answer any of the concerns that the channel had.
Yes.
None of these things are going away.
No.
If you thought Leo was the wrong guy because of the strategy, yet you're still convinced, you know, from the Meg Whitman standpoint, who was part of that decision-making process, that they were the right strategies, then why is Leo gone? It doesn't make any sense.
Just because he was a bad communicator?
They trotted out the bad communicator.
I hate that.
Well, come on.
Bad communicator. I mean, like, how much can you put on that as the reason to get rid of the guy? I mean, clearly
these were extremely bold moves that were being made.
Yes.
So if those were the right moves and he was the guy that pushed them through, then communication is not really the thing that you'd kick him out the door on.
Yeah.
I mean, when you and I also talked about before the particulars came out on what exactly was happening, like, you know, has this guy just been sandbagged? Has somebody on the board, I know some names were thrown around, maybe it's Mark Andreessen that doesn't like him, whatever it is somebody on this board really, you know, unhappy with the direction? They leaked a lot of this stuff, like that whole PSG mess came from a press leak from somebody on the board.
Someone had to.
And, you know, kind of throwing him to the wolves and trying to get him out. So now, say that is the case, now what? Did they lose again? Because now they've just gotten, you know, another you know, person that's going to take us down that same path? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, a lot of the partners ahead of the final word that it was going to be Meg Whitman, there was, you know, definitely reports that something was amiss, that Leo was on his way out, you know, who was going to be the replacement. You know, partners are kind of looking back to the HP of old, saying, gee, I wish we could get somebody that would bring a little bit of Mark Hurd and a little bit of Carly Fiorina and take us back to, you know, the HP way a little bit. Just kind of bring a lot of those pieces together. Is that going to be Meg Whitman? I don't think so. She doesn't have any channel experience. She has no enterprise experience.
Well, Jen, if you heard on the call yesterday that Ray Lane took exception with that, you know, what Meg Whitman wasn't, and said, hey, people can change. I think he made a reference to Ronald Reagan at one point, saying, hey, Ronald Reagan was an actor and he ended up being a great president. Now, I don't know what's going on with Ray Lane. I don't know what's going on with HP's board right now. I think it's important to note that Ray Lane came to HP the same time. He was appointed to the board the same time that they hired Leo Apotheker. On the same day, it was in the same announcement. And I believe it was Robert Ryan, who was the member of the board of directors at that time, who was sort of taking the lead. And he's, you know, he was the guy who came out, and, you know, in the press and in the official press release saying, hey, you know, here's Leo. He's a great guy. He's going to be the right guy to take us to take HP forward. And we also got Ray Lane, great operational guy, rich history with Kleiner Perkins, and obviously, you know, a lead executive, a CEO under Larry Ellison at Oracle. And yet, a few months later, Ryan and a lot of other members of the board mysteriously don't put themselves up for re-election or are pushed out. Who knows? So there's five or six guys gone, including Ryan, and there's a bunch of new people brought in. And one of those people is Meg Whitman. So Ray Lane and Leo Apotheker saw, you know, like, okay, let's bring in some of our own guys. And Meg Whitman was one.
Note that Leo was also a director.
And he was a director at the time, too. And now you have that same sort of group of people that has led us to this point. Now, still calling the shots, just because Leo isn't there anymore as CEO, looks like a lot of the decisions that are being made at a high level in that company are still coming from that sort of new guard of directors, along with Ray Lane, and now Meg Whitman, who was brought in as a new director. So it's, you just have to wonder about what is this board doing? Where are they going? And I don't care. Like, I know Lane was on that call yesterday saying, hey, this wasn't the board that hired Leo. This wasn't the same board that, you know, got in trouble for the pretexting controversy around that, you know, right before they brought in Hurd. I don't care. If I'm an HP investor, I don't care. I care that the company doesn't have a clear strategy right now. I care that the stock price is at a six-year low today, the day after they tried to reverse, you know, the trend of the stock going
down.
Which is
interesting, because when it was still rumored that the changes were coming, the stock actually rose.
The stock actually rose. The stock was up, you know, Wednesday and Thursday on the news that they were going to, you know, move Leo out and bring in somebody new. Well, they do that, and they have that analyst call, and none of the questions were really answered. And, yeah, I know it's not the same board as some of the, you know, the ones that had committed missteps in the past, but they're still some of the same members. And then you have this new group, this new faction, and who knows where they're taking HP and what their objective is. If they're bringing somebody in, if they're saying that Meg Whitman has this great sort of, you know, background as more of a consumer-focused executive, well, great. But you just told us you're going to spin off your PC business, a big part of your consumer business. You want to be more enterprise and software-focused. So which is it? Which HP are you going to be? Which direction are you going in? And I don't know with the current regime, including the board of directors, like, I don't know that we're going to get that answer.
I cover IBM, and I have to contrast what I'm seeing here at HP with IBM.
It's night and day.
Because you and I had a podcast early this year after an IBM partner conference where we talked about how IBM has clearly delineated their strategic initiatives, business intelligence, cloud, the smarter planet infrastructure, emerging markets, you know, one or two others, and everything that IBM does, particularly acquisitions, you know exactly how it fits into that bigger picture. And while I think I agree with Andrew that the autonomy acquisition was a good move, price aside, I just don't know how it fits into the bigger picture at HP.
Yeah.
And that is what they're missing over there. And I don't know if the new regime is the right people to do that, but that's what I'm missing right now.
Yeah, fear that they had a strategy. The strategy was to go more software.
Yeah.
And, you know, come hell or high water, Leo Apotheker was on that path.
Which
and
is
now,
fine.
And which is fine. If that's what you're going to do, that's what you're going to do, as long as it's communicated well. And now, you know, they've pushed him aside, but, you know, it's like somebody got scared that maybe that wasn't the right path. Maybe it is. Who knows? There's, everyone's so upset with this. Let's just do something.
It's just interesting that they made the executive change, but they haven't made any... They haven't said that, hey, we're going to review some of the decisions we've made or some of the strategic moves we've made or the direction the company is going in. They just seem to be falling back on, he wasn't the right guy, he wasn't a great communicator, it's time for new leadership. Well, maybe it's time for a new plan. Maybe it's time for a new direction.
Maybe it's time for a new board.
A new port. I mean, they've got 14 members, I think, of the board. Maybe it's 13 now that Lane is executive chairman.
And Leo's out.
But it just, you know, you just got to look at this and say they're reeling. They're adrift. They don't know what they're, you know, there seems to be a tug of war leadership-wise. Like, who is steering the ship? And why, for the love of God... We've been, you know, you've been here more than 10 years. I've been doing this for more than 10 years. Rick, obviously, you've been doing this more than 10 years. Since 1999, since they went outside the company to bring in Carly Fiorina, they've gone outside the company now three times to get a new executive. There's nobody within HP that they could have looked at, not Donatelli, not Ann Livermore, not Todd Bradley, that they could have said, hey, maybe it's time, if we want to preserve the HP way and we want to really make this company work, let's get somebody who's been in here for more than like 8 months. And they just don't seem willing to do that.
The travesty of the whole thing, and I think it's partly why our colleague Steve Burke isn't here, because he's still heartbroken over this whole
issue. He would be having a meltdown.
Issue. Yeah. It's just that it's such a fantastic portfolio of products.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's such a strong channel powerhouse.
Yeah.
And to not be able to make that work somehow,
yeah.
to make all these moves that just bring all of that to a screeching halt,
sure.
it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And the channel partners are desperate for some sort of answer, some stability,
yeah.
some direction, all these things we've been talking about. And I'm sorry, but we didn't get that last night.
Yeah.
We didn't get it.
No.
Maybe we'll get it in 12 months. I don't know. But we didn't get it tonight.
No.
Last night, which means that it's just more of the same. Partners are just going to be in limbo. As they've been in limbo for the last few months anyway.
Yeah.
They didn't get anything, no definitive answers on what's going to happen with PSG. Is it happening or not? We got more, looking at the strategy and thinking it's okay. So they just didn't get anything that's going to make a real difference in their day-to-day lives in the sales trenches in any limited foreseeable future.
Whatever happens, it's going to give us plenty of material because this is not going away anytime soon. I mean, what these guys are going to do, the board, Meg Whitman, and the executives, these poor guys underneath, the top level there, they're going to have a lot of work ahead of them trying to figure out what the best course of action for the entire company, not just PSG, and partners are going to be kind of on the edge of their seat the whole time, as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And, we just...
And it's all really going to be done under a microscope.
Yeah.
From this point on. Every little thing people are going to be analyzing
yeah.
closely.
It's true.
And you're going to have a very angry group of shareholders if this doesn't turn around quickly.
I know. I can't wait to see what happens.
And that's never good for long-term decision-making
yeah,
if you're doing it under the pressure of angry shareholders.
Yeah, I know. If the stock price is still dropping next week, I mean, they're going to have Oh, I don't even want to think about it, but...
Let's send some good wishes toward HP and the HP channel. Here's hoping that, that things do start to solidify, that some answers come out, that channel partners get the direction that they're desperately waiting for, and their customers as well. Because without a strong HP channel presence, it's a grim world. It's a grim world.
Yeah, a lot of guys that we know, a lot of our readers are going to be hurt. So best wishes to the new regime at HP, and hopefully they turn it around soon.
Prove all the naysayers wrong.
Yes, there you go. Well, I'm Rob Wright.
I'm Jen Follett.
And I'm Rick Whiting.
And thanks for listening.